Our guest is Jeffrey Rosenthal. He's professor in the Department of Statistics at the University of Toronto. He's enjoyed flipping coins and rolling dice for as long as he can remember. And we're going to talk about his latest book this hour. It's called Struck by Lightning, The Curious World of Probabilities. Jeffrey Rosenthal, I thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, so first of all, does this all come down to whether or not we can control things, things we can control, things we can't control?
Well, I would argue that if there's something we can completely control, then there is no randomness and probability, but randomness and probability come in when there are things that we can't control, which is an awful lot of things, right? Whenever we have to deal with other people, whenever we're not sure if the bus is going to be late, we're not sure if we're going to win the lottery, we're not sure, as you say, if we're going to get a disease, or we listen to an opinion poll or a medical study, and we're not sure if we should believe the results. Those are things we can't completely control. So what I argue in the book is that by just a little bit of an understanding of how randomness and probability works, well, we can't control the uncertainty, but we can understand it and we can make the best of it.
All right. So we were just talking about the presidential election 2008. And
right.
Of course, polling is going to be more numerous now as we go through the coming months and a couple of years here. What do these polls really indicate? How accurate are they? And how do we know a good poll from a bad poll?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's an awful lot of factors that go into polls. So polls will usually quote what they call the margin of error. And that's a pretty interesting thing, which I talk about in the book quite a bit. And that's to do with how many people did they sample and how close is the answer that they got? How close is it to what it would have been if they'd actually taken the trouble to phone everybody? So that's a pretty important value. But that doesn't tell the whole story, because even if you called everybody, polls still have their limitations. So, for example, not everyone will agree to talk to pollsters. And, in fact, it's a bit of a dark secret in the polling industry that only something like one-third of people will actually respond to them or be home and so on. So it means you're maybe not getting the whole story because you're only hearing from the people who are actually willing to talk to pollsters. And then some people won't want to tell the truth to pollsters. Maybe they're feeling a certain way, but they're a little embarrassed about it, or they're getting pressure not to say it. Or, of course, the big thing is that people will change their minds between now and when they're going to vote. So you're never actually predicting the future. You're just saying what people are feeling right now. And there's other factors, too. So in other words, you're not getting the whole story. You're just getting, a sample, which may have its own biases.
Is this really a good snapshot of the political landscape, then? I mean, can we trust these polls?
Well, we can trust them to some extent. And, I mean, one thing the pollsters have going for them is that they have a pretty good history. I mean, they've made some big boo-boos, but for the most part, polls do a pretty good job of predicting elections and other things. So, you know, yes, we can trust them to some extent, but we should always keep in mind, for example, who's running the poll. Was it a professional polling company who has years of experience doing things in an unbiased way, or was it some interest group with their own axe to grind who is kind of skewing the questions their own way? So that's a big deal. And also, you know, how are things going to change between now and the vote and those kind of things? You should always kind of think about the polls. And I think, yes, they say a lot, but you have to think about them too.
I think there should be an agency regulating these polls.
Yeah, well, I mean, of course it's hard, because when you're dealing with randomness and uncertainty, one problem is there could be, you know, fraud if people are actually, you know, mishandling polls, or if they're being, biased in the way they conduct them. But to a large extent with the professional polling companies, that's not the issue. But then there's still, let's say, these other issues. You know, are people really telling the truth? Are they doing their sample well? Are they sampling a big enough sample? So it's a hard thing, even if you did have a regulatory body.
All right. So what is this error rate then really taking into account, or perhaps covering up? I mean, any poll carries an error rate of plus or minus X percent.
Yeah.
What does that really mean, and what should we be listening for?
Yeah, well, so a good way to think about that is to imagine you're flipping coins, and because you mentioned I love flipping coins. And if you flip a coin, it should be a 50% probability if it's going to be heads or tails. Well, suppose you flip 1,000 coins. Well, you'll probably get close to 500 of them heads and 500 tails, but you won't get exactly 500 heads and 500 tails. So, you know, maybe one time you'll get 460 heads and 540 tails and so on. And the margin of error is really a measurement of that. It's saying that even if you were sampling things perfectly, like flipping a coin, how close would you be to getting a true sample of the true probability, or the overall population? So how close will you be to 50% heads? And the more coins you flip, or the more people you sample in a poll, the closer you'll get in that sense. So that's what the margin of error is measuring. And I talk in the book, there's actually a pretty simple formula to work out what the margin of error is. And the more people you ask, the smaller that margin of error will be. And that does give you an indication of how much error the poll has because they maybe didn't sample enough people. So that's one aspect. But as far as those biases or the people who won't talk to pollsters, that's much harder to quantify, and that's not part of the margin of error.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about medical studies for a moment. I mean, they're always saying on the news, studies show this,
yeah,
studies show that, or if you use this kind of detergent, your clothes are going to be whiter. If you use this mm-hmm. drug, you're going to be at less risk for heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what of this should we buy as consumers of news?
Right. Well, I mean, it's important as a consumer, I think, to understand what a poll is, what a result of a study, what it means. So usually if they do something like, let's say, study whether a certain drug is going to reduce a certain disease, well, they'll give this drug to a whole bunch of people, and then they'll have a control group of people that they didn't give it to, and then they'll wait and see, you know, how many of the people who got the drug get the disease, how many people who did not get the drug get the disease. And if fewer people got the disease with the drug, well, that's probably a good sign. But then you say, well, maybe that would happen just by luck. I mean, after all, whenever you have, you know, different groups of people, some of them are going to be unlucky and get a disease, and some of them are going to be lucky and avoid it. So then the question becomes, is this result something which was just by luck and actually the pill didn't help at all, or does this really prove that the pill helped? So one way to approach it, which is what's usually done, is to compute what they call the p-value. And the p-value stands for the probability that the observed result happened just by chance. The pill didn't help at all. There's nothing to prove here. It was just luck. And there's a scientific standard that if that p-value, the probability was just luck, if that was less than one chance in 20 or a 5%, then we say, well, that's unlikely enough that this is a statistically significant result and it really proves that the pill works. So that's not a bad standard, but it's worth remembering that any study, you know, there's maybe as much as one chance in 20 that the result was just pure luck and it actually didn't mean anything.
Okay, so pure luck. What about pure cheating?
Well, that's a whole other thing. Just like with the polls, if the polling company is going to, you know, cheat in the way they ask the questions, it's hard to quantify that. And, yeah, if the people conducting the medical study are going to, you know, only give the pill to the patients that seemed like they were about to get better anyway, or one thing which is a big issue, if they're only going to publish the result if it proves that the pill worked, and if it doesn't, then they're just not going to publish it, then those are big issues. And then you're not getting the whole story, and then they can quote all the p-values and statistical significance that they want, and it's not actually going to mean anything. So one issue, for example, is if a pharmaceutical company, which has billions of dollars at stake in whether their pill is proven to help with the disease, if they're able to, you know, fund the studies and then decide, well, this study looks pretty good for us, so we'll publish that one in the journals and we'll publicize it and so on, but this study looks pretty bad for us, so we'll keep that one kind of hush-hush. If they can do that, then they can prove just about anything they want. So it's very important, and the medical journals are starting to adopt a standard that says that when they commission a study, one of the deals has to be that the researcher has the right to publish the data, the results, regardless of what it proves, and that's very important.
So the drug companies can commission any number of studies, and then just at this point publish the one with the favorable outcome.
Well, yeah, in theory they could, and that's why the leading medical journals, they've been declaring in the last few years that they're not going to allow that to continue. They're going to say that the research agreement had to be that the research was allowed to be published regardless of what it showed. And to me, that's the key. You know, I don't know which pills are good and which pills are bad, but I do know that we need to see the whole story.
All right, but now even without publication bias, aren't there ways in statistics to manipulate almost any group of numbers to affect a certain result?
That's right. There's all different kinds of bias, and one is what we call this sort of an observational bias, and this occurs actually just in everyday life too. You know, if you really believe a certain thing, you know, people with this color hair tend to do this, then you're only going to remember those people who did that, and you're going to forget all the people with that color hair who did not do that action. So in other words, we tend to just remember things that prove our point of view. And similarly, if you're, say, writing for a newspaper and you really want to prove something, well, if you can just quote those examples which illustrate your point and hush-hush the examples which are kind of the opposite, then you can prove anything. And that's really what statistical bias can come down to, is reporting the facts selectively or only reporting, you know, certain aspects that show your point of view. And so what you always want, if you want to know what to believe, is you want to know you're getting the whole story, the people actually reporting all the information that's available.
All right, this relates to your one of the wonderful stories in your book. You sprinkle these stories throughout the book, the happiness hat story. Do you want to tell that to us?
Yeah, so let's see if I can remember it. As you say, there's a lot of stories, but yeah, I think I remember that it's where somebody, the company says, hey, we've got these new kind of hats, and we claim that, they make people happy when you wear them, right? And people say, oh, how can it be true? They say, well, we're going to commission studies, and yeah, if I'm recalling the right story, then they commission 100 studies, and, most of the studies say, look, the people with the hats or the people without the hats, they were all about equally happy. It didn't prove anything. And maybe a couple studies say, gee, the people with the hats, they actually were less happy than the people without the hats. But there's one study that you commissioned, number 57, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, I think that's the one.
And it says, according to this study, look, it so happened that the people wearing the hats were much happier in this study than the people not wearing the hats. And then if you're able to, take all those other studies and put them through your executive class paper shredder and never let anyone hear about those, but take that one study, study number 57, and publicize it and get people on, the news media talking about it, then maybe everyone's going to buy your happiness hat. So it's a bit of a silly example, but it does illustrate this point that, you want to say, well, wait a minute, how many studies were there for that happiness hat or the medical pill or whatever? And can we get the whole story, please, not just the selected part?
That is a great story. But it is so easy to mislead the public. I mean, we can't be sitting here, thinking about p-values and the random sample, whether or not they used randomized trials and whether there was sampling bias. Shouldn't this all be done ahead of time so we've got it all right there? We don't have to go digging for this bias?
Yeah, I guess first of all, I'd say, of course, you can sit around thinking about p-values. Everyone should read my book and do exactly that. But also, I mean, of course, you're right. To some extent, I guess one could say that the media has some of a responsibility, that if they're reporting on, hey, this study showed so-and-so, it would be nice in an ideal world if the media people were able to investigate and say, hold on, this guy actually has a bias. He's actually trying to prove something, but he didn't give us the whole story, so we shouldn't believe it, whereas, hey, this other study was done pretty well, and it really seems to mean anything. But in some sense, it may be asking a lot of the media, because there are going to be a lot of conflicting studies and conflicting opinions, and we don't necessarily want the media to filter everything for us either. We want to be able to think about it as individual citizens, but I would argue, think about it from the point of view of understanding the probabilities and so on.
That's right. Well, we all remember our wonderful stats classes, all of that terminology and methodology and the bell curves and the standard deviations. I actually liked my stats classes, but I don't know too many others who did.
Yeah, well,
what's wrong with the way we're teaching?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's right. I mean, first of all, I'm, of course, thrilled to hear that you liked your stats class, but you're right. I mean, a lot of people, they, take one stats class because they had to take it for their program, and the person teaching it is someone who didn't really want to teach that class anyway, and, they have to cover a lot of sort of, technical material so they can answer the questions on the exams. And I think it's true that, for some students that works well, but what tends to get lost sometimes is sort of the big picture of what it all means and why it's important. And, I mean, that's really one of the main reasons that I wrote this book, is to say, well, look, you don't need all the mathematical formulae and things that will confuse people. You just need to look at the big picture and understand it a little bit. And I think from the point of view of sort of being an informed citizen, as opposed to doing your actual research in statistics, but being an informed citizen, it's more important, I think, to have an understanding of, what it all means and how we should think about it, instead of getting all the formulae right so you can pass the exam. And I think that's maybe what the problem is.
All right. Well, speaking of the big picture, this might be a bit esoteric for you, but we talked yesterday on this program about the importance of imagination and about some of the, how the greatest scientists were able to see the solutions to the problems they were solving. And one of the stories was a young child who discovered infinity by blowing bubbles. He saw the bubbles as zeros stretching one after the other all the way up to the sky. And I know you have been fascinated with numbers ever since you were a small child. Did you ever make a discovery like that? And do you ever see the actual problem in your mind as pictures and images rather than just the set of dry numbers?
Certainly yes to the last part. That is, I think any, working mathematician or statistician, once you start to sort of understand the things as opposed to just, try to memorize the formula for the final exam, which is unfortunately what it is for a lot of people. But once you really start thinking, what's the meaning of it and how can I expand on it, because I do research, so you're always trying to come up with new things and new perspectives, then yeah, absolutely. I think everyone has their images. In fact, it's it's hard to say exactly what mathematicians' images are because they tend to differ. And I know one famous French mathematician wrote a book about that question, about trying to say what does he picture in his mind when he's going through a mathematical proof. But I think it's definitely true that working mathematicians work on sort of two levels at once. And one is the really formal thing where you get all the Greek letters just right and so on. And then the other level is, some sort of picture or image of what it means and, why things work and so on. And it can be hard to find that balance. I mean, many students get too trapped in, the Greek letters and so on and don't see the big picture. But on the other hand, you do need that too, because if you go too far to just saying, well, it's just my image and my imagination and so on, then at some point you start imagining things which aren't really true as well. So,
well, I mean, I could argue the very nature of statistical analysis is in some ways imaginary because we're projecting these results into the future. We're talking about probability and likelihood. We don't know the actual result.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's really what randomness is all about, is trying to, I mean, it's been described as, trying to solve the unsolvable, or trying to, impose mathematical ideas on unknown, right? So you say, well, gee, if we don't know, how can we use mathematics? But the answer is, well, we can, because we can sort of quantify how much we don't know in terms of the probabilities.
All right. Well, we're going to take a short break. I want to ask Mike in Racine just to hold on for a few moments here. We're going to get to your call in just a moment. Jeffrey Rosenthal is our guest. He's professor in the Department of Statistics from Toronto University, and we're talking about his new book, Struck by Lightning, The Curious World of Probabilities. From big money jackpots to planes crashing, bridges collapsing, diseases striking, how likely is it any of these things will actually happen to us during our lifetime? In the case of the lottery, I'm sure we'd all like to know how to increase our chances. What phenomena are you curious about? Just everyday, ordinary things. 800-642-1234 is the number to join in. The Madison number, 263-1890. Back in just a moment, I'm Catherine Brond. Happy to be with you this Thursday on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up tomorrow at this time, summer reading for kids. The best books to share with your children. An editor from the New York Times will be with us. And of course, we'll want to hear what you've been reading. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 10. Catherine Brond in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to have you along on this Thursday. We're talking this hour about the curious world of probabilities. Jeffrey Rosenthal is with us. His new book is called Struck by Lightning. How likely is it? Deconstructing the odds and the oddities of chance. We're talking about polling, medical studies, how accurate these kinds of surveys are and what they really predict. And talking about randomness and how much control we can have over that. The number for you to join in is 800-642-1234. In Madison, a local call for you at 263-1890. Let's get right to the phones. Mike has been waiting in Racine. Hi, Mike. Thanks for being patient.
Hi. This is a great subject, and I'm definitely going to read the guest's book. I'm a retired physician, and commonly in medical literature, a concept of meta-analysis is used, where an author will statistically analyze a group of studies. And I'd like the guest to comment on meta-analysis, to define it for us and to tell us what the pitfalls of this approach is. And I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thanks very much, Mike. Jeffrey Rosenthal.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so it's a good question. So meta-analysis stands for the subject of sort of collecting a bunch of analyses that were already done and combining them all together. So in the case of medical studies, it basically boils down to going back and looking at what are all the studies that have been done about this topic, and let's combine them all and see what they all prove when taken as a group. And it's an extremely important thing because of, like what we were talking about, that any one study, well, if you've commissioned a bunch of studies, any one study might show just about anything. So, but then if you go back and you say, well, okay, this one study that everyone heard about says we should take this pill, but look, here's three other studies that studied that pill and said it was actually a bad idea. And when you put those all together, you'll say, well, actually, the bad studies outweigh the good study, and actually, you shouldn't take the pill. So it's a very important subject, and it's one that I think statisticians are sort of more looking at more in recent years than they used to, because used to be you'd say, well, look, here's a study. Let's just think about that one study. And as far as the pitfalls, well, one big pitfall is the question of whether you can actually find all the studies that have been done. And in particular, if the studies were commissioned by companies that had an interest, and if they made sure that they weren't published, Well, boy, it's pretty hard to find those unpublished studies from, you know, 10 or 20 years ago that no one really wanted you to hear about in the first place. So that's why it's very important to say they should be published. But even once they're published, then it comes down to, in some sense, the librarians and the researchers to really go through all the journals and use searching techniques and say, let's find all the studies, not just the one that made the front page news that they wanted us to hear about, but all the ones, and really combine them. And if you're able to really combine them, then you can get a much more accurate picture.
Yeah, sounds very comprehensive.
Yeah, but it's hard, though. It's hard to find them all. So.
Difficult. All right. So. Thanks for the call, Mike. Another Mike is next in Madison. Hi, Mike. It's Mike and Mike. What's the probability of that? Two callers in a row named Mike.
Well, with his name like Mike, it's pretty probable. Yeah, we were talking about how easy it is to fool the public and how people don't understand numbers. And the one that's always stuck in my craw is decaffeinated coffee, so to speak. And there's a decaf coffee that claims to be 97% caffeine-free. And then another coffee came out and said, don't take all my caffeine, just take half. And regular coffee is about 6% caffeine, so by definition it's 94% caffeine-free. And half of 6% is 3, so they're actually the same. And people think they're really getting a big savings on caffeine by drinking decaf coffee. And in reality, it's always about half, no matter what.
So another example of pulling the wool over our eyes. I mean, do we all have to be mathematicians, Jeffrey Rosenthal, to figure this stuff out?
Yeah, well, no. I mean, what I try to argue in the book is that, you know, you don't need to be a mathematician. You just need to stop and think a little bit, right? And somehow, especially as it's true when it comes to numbers, some of these people, you know, they don't really want to stop and think just for that 1 minute. They say, oh, I don't want to think about numbers. And, you know, I would say, well, it's fine if you're not a numbers person and you don't want to specialize in mathematical research as I have, but you know, just stop for a minute or two and just think, well, when they make a claim, yeah, whether it's in advertising or other things, you know, what does it mean? Does it really prove things? So, you know, if you're seeing a TV commercial for a weight loss product and they're having people quoted saying, oh, I lost 23 pounds, think, well, weren't there some other people who tried that product, but they didn't lose the weight? You know, it just takes that 1 second to think about what are they trying to tell me and what's the truth behind it. And it can go a long way. You don't need to be a mathematician. You just need to stop and think.
All right. Well, thanks, Mike, for the call. And you know what? Boy, I tell you, we have another Mike waiting. I mean, okay, we had two in a row, but three
in
a row?
Yeah, this is getting suspicious.
All right. How about the other Mike? Hi, Mike.
Yes, hi. Well, back in my high school history class, there were six Mikes in one class. I didn't learn statistics formally. I didn't learn it in college or in high school. But I did learn about statistics when I first read the old classic, How to Lie with Statistics.
Yes.
And when I first read that book, I was fascinated with statistics and how you see it. It's so ubiquitous. I mean, you just see it everywhere. And the most interesting portion of statistics in my mind is the distribution curve, the normal distribution curve. I see it everywhere I go.
Yeah.
And, you know, in fact, just a few weeks ago, I was sitting in the local grocery store parking lot and just kind of seeing the people coming and going in the store. And I was just kind of playing a sort of a mind game with myself. And I was thinking, well, what if everybody in the entire city of Amory all decided to go to this grocery store at exactly the same moment? You know, what would happen? Of course, the parking lot would be just totally, you know, overflowing with people and cars.
Mm.
But statistics doesn't allow that. So there's a probability that not everybody in the entire town of Amory will go to that one grocery store at the same moment, you know, on the same day. There is a distribution curve to just about everything in life. And since I've learned statistics on my own, I tend to see that everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, first of all, your basic point that, you know, there's probability and randomness and distributions everywhere is absolutely true. And, yeah, your example about, you know, the parking lot, I mean, it's true that really the what we call the law of large numbers, that if you have lots of people, then they'll tend to spread out or and so on. That really helps us, as you say, every day. Why not everyone's in the same store? Although I'm a little nervous that there were three mics in a row. That goes a bit against that, but absolutely. And it's also related, for example, to the margins of error in polls that we were talking about. Those are calculated all based on that sort of bell curve. So if you imagine, for example, that really, you know, 40% of the people support a certain candidate, and you do a poll of 1,000 people, and then you do another poll, and you sort of mark with an X where they all are, well, the X's will be near to 40%, but they'll be spread out around 40%, and their shape will be like the bell curve again, that distributional curve. So, yeah, it comes up everywhere that whenever there's uncertainty, whether it's a poll or people in the parking lot or the names of people phoning in, that they tend over the long run to follow certain distributions.
All right.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, Mike. Jeffrey Rosenthal, could you explain to us what the probability perspective is?
Right. Well, so that's a phrase that I coined for the book. And so I sort of thought, you know, what's my dream with this book? Well, hopefully people will find it, you know, interesting and entertaining and so on. But hopefully it will lead the world to have a little more probability perspective, by which I just mean kind of, you know, taking that 1 minute to stop and think and understand, you know, as the caller said, why not everyone goes to the same parking lot on the same day, or what the medical studies mean, or, you know, why it's actually pretty safe to fly in an airplane, even if you've read that there's a big airplane crash, or just whatever information you take in, just taking that 1 minute to just understand what probabilities are all about. If you can do that, you've got a probability perspective, and I'll be happy.
Okay. And it is based on rational thought about randomness, and not irrational emotional responses, which I think many of us tend to have, me included in that. You know, we see something terrible on the news, and we're very fearful about it, or I know I do this. I tend to generalize based on my personal associations. You know, you have one bad experience at the doctor's office, and therefore all doctors are bad.
Yeah.
You know, kids do that a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, I think we all do, and I'm sure that I do it as well. But, you know, I try to catch myself. And, you know, yeah, when a good example is, you know, you read about some terrible thing happening, and then people say, oh, my gosh, it's going to happen to me next, or it's going to happen to my child next or something. And it's worth just stopping and thinking, well, you know, how many people live in that region and how many of them actually had this problem? And, you know, people read that, let's say, a child was abducted, and, of course, it's a terrible thing. But then everyone will think, oh, my child's next. And you say, well, wait a minute. This is, you know, one child out of, you know, millions and millions of people, and it doesn't mean that all children are about to be abducted. So it's just worth thinking. It can help us to fear less, because we realize that actually usually everything will be fine.
Sounds like a good stress reduction technique.
Yeah, I think it can be.
All right, let's see. Next is, well, not another Mike, but a name that starts with an M. It's Mary, and Mary joins us from Gays Mills. Hi, Mary.
Hi, this is fun. I never thought I would enjoy a show on statistics. When I was in college, it was the one course that I actually skipped a lot in and took pass fail. Terrible. But anyway, I appreciate it now. And I have a fun probability question, and I guess I need to know what formula to figure it out here. I live in a rural area, but there's a really dangerous intersection about 50 yards from our front yard. And I have a little girl that spends a lot of time in the front yard out there, and I'm wondering how probable is it that we're going to have a car crash in this yard, given that it has occurred a couple of times during the past 20 years.
Ooh, what do you think about that?
Well, certainly something to think about. I mean, car crashes are actually, you know, more dangerous than some other things that people fear more. So you're right to be somewhat concerned. As far as getting into the exact probabilities, you know, I'd have to look at the whole history and, you know, how often the cars go by, how many crashes exactly were there. And also, of course, if there is a crash, it doesn't necessarily come to your front lawn. Or if it does, then hopefully not necessarily is there someone there to be hurt and so on. But, you know, it is worth stopping and thinking. And, you know, when I try to make the point in the book that you don't want to have irrational fears where you're constantly worried about something bad that might happen. But on the other hand, if there is some probability that something might happen, it may be worth taking corrective measures. So it may be worth putting up a fence or some other thing to try to make it a more safe situation. And, you know, I try to make the point, as I say, that we should, you know, take measures and be cautious, but without being overly fearful. And so I, you know, urge the caller, Mary, to, you know, don't sit around worrying about how terrible it's going to be. But at the same time, if there's something you can do to make it a little more safe, then I'd be all for it.
Okay, so maybe like wearing seat belts and bike helmets.
Yeah, that's right. I talk about those in the book, actually, because I actually ride my bike a lot. And, you know, I do wear a bike helmet. And, you know, when I was writing this book, I was trying to make the point that, you know, these things we worry about mostly aren't that likely to occur. So, you know, it's not that likely that I'm going to get hit by a car while I'm riding my bike. But then you think, well, it isn't that hard to put on a bike helmet. You know, it's not that big an inconvenience. It's not that much trouble. So that's why it makes sense. You know, it's not worth saying I'm never going to bike again and I'm just going to lock myself in my house because I might get into a problem. But it is worth saying something that I can take as a precaution that isn't very inconvenient is worth it.
Right. All right. Now, we've all caught ourselves saying this. Oh, what are the odds of that? You know, you meet some friends at a dinner party and everybody's wearing the same color. do we just chalk this up to coincidence? Is this an astounding coincidence? Run-of-the-mill coincidence? I mean, what is this? Is it just random?
Right, yeah. So, I talk about this in the book, too, of course, and I talk about what I call the out-of-how-many principle. So that is to say, if you take any one such incident, you say, look, you know, I was traveling in Paris this one time, and I happened to meet this one friend that I hadn't seen since high school, and, you know, what's the chance that, you know, she would have been in Paris at the same time as me? Then, of course, the odds will be extremely low, and you'll say, wow, this must really mean something special. But then you stop and say, well, wait a minute, you know, I would have been surprised if I ran into any of my old friends from high school or any of my extended relatives or any of my work colleagues. Or you start realizing there's probably, you know, a few hundred people or more that you would have been equally surprised to run into. And then you say, well, I could have run into them at the airport, or I could have run into them at the hotel, or I could have run into them when I was out walking. And you start realizing you've probably passed by thousands and thousands of people on this trip. And if any one of them had been any of those hundreds of people that you would have been surprised to see, that would have been surprising. And then you say, well, you didn't just take this one trip to Paris, but you've traveled to other places and you've done other things over the course of your years. And then you start realizing that over the course of a long lifetime, it's quite likely that at some time or other, some really surprising thing is going to happen. And I mean, it's fun and exciting when it happens, but it doesn't necessarily prove some, you know, deep meaning, because sure, it's going to happen. And in fact, I've given talks where, you know, I'll ask, you know, how many people have a story something like that, you know, because I have one, and then I talk about other people's story of, you know, running into somebody completely unexpectedly, and, you know, most people have put up their hands. They have some story at some point in their life.
Sure. It's sort of like 6 degrees of separation.
Yeah, well, if it's related to that, I mean, that's this idea that, you know, everyone in the world is, you know, a friend of 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 a friend, and it's sort of true that these possibilities multiply. So, you know, I have maybe a few hundred people that I know well, but then each of them has a few hundred people that they know well. So when you put that together, the people who are 2 degrees from me is, well, a few hundred multiplied by a few hundred, roughly speaking. So it sort of quickly gets up in, you know, the tens of thousands. And then you say, well, each of them has friends, and each of them has friends. And pretty quickly it just explodes and covers, nobody really knows exactly for sure, but roughly speaking, covers the whole world as friends of friends of friends of friends and so on.
Sure. Are there situations numbers simply can't tell us about? I mean, can we translate these subjective experiences into numerical values?
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly not entirely. I mean, you know, we all have, you know, emotions and feelings and opinions and so on, and they don't all come back down to numbers. So I don't take the position that, you know, everything is numbers. You just have to understand it. But what I do say is that understanding probability and uncertainty can help in a lot of situations. And one thing I talk about in the book is what are called utility functions. And there's this idea that if you're faced with some decision involving randomness, maybe you're planning a party and you don't know whether to have it indoors or outdoors, but if you have it outdoors, it might rain and that might be a mess, then I say, well, okay, mathematics can't tell you whether to have your party indoors or outdoors, but what it can do is help by saying, first of all, you should make a numerical assignment of what we call your utilities, which are how good and bad you personally feel each outcome would be. So how good would it be to have a party outdoors on a sunny day? How bad would it be if you got caught in the rain? How okay would it be if the party was indoors but it was still kind of fun? And then if you put that all together, then once you choose the numbers, because that's not mathematics, that's your own personal opinions, but once you've made that choice, then we can look at it mathematically and we can say, well, what's the probability it's going to rain? And if it did rain and you had the party outdoors, what would be your utility then? And we can put it all together and we can say, well, based on those numbers that you've given, here's whether you should have it indoors or outdoors. So we can't reduce everything to numbers, but we can say once you have your opinions, then the numbers can help.
I think I want to get a program like that for my computer. I just plug in the numbers
every
morning. Yeah, well,
you can do that, or you can even do it without a program. You just need to use utilities.
All right. How about things, you know, gut feelings? Or, you know, when we think, oh, this must have been in the stars. I suppose you don't put much credence into things like that. You know, things sometimes seem preordained.
Yeah.
At least we like to think they might be.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard to give a blanket answer because people can mean all kinds of related things by that. It's true that I don't sort of believe that there's, you know, some controlling force that's making it work out a certain way. But what I do believe is that, I mean, first of all, it's perfectly reasonable to form your opinions based on whatever surprising things happen. You know, if you happen to run into somebody, well, maybe you should go out to dinner with them. You know, I've got no problem with that, because that's a part of what makes life exciting. And as far as gut feeling, I mean, sometimes gut feelings are actually based on knowledge that we may have, but we just might not be able to pin down where we have it. You know, you say, I've got a gut feeling that this guy can't be trusted. And, well, it's because somewhere in your past you met somebody kind of similar and he turned out not to be telling the truth, and you're kind of putting two and two together, even if you can't remember that other person. So gut feelings, I think, often are based on reasonable facts, and there's no reason not to follow them. But, you know, it doesn't mean that there's magic involved. It just means we can't understand everything.
All right. Well, we're going to take another short break and then more of your phone calls. When we come back, Jeffrey Rosenthal is our guest, a stats professor from the University of Toronto. He's author of Struck by Lightning, The Curious World of Probabilities. It's just out in paperback by Joseph Henry Press. When it comes to randomness, you can run, but you can't hide. Our guest, Math Whiz, showing us how to understand the way probability works in a simple fashion. He says it can help us make better decisions in our daily lives and help us not to feel so fearful about things. We're at 800-642-1234. In Madison, the number 263-1890. Catherine Brond in for Kathleen Dunn. Back in just a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next hour on the Ideas Network, Larry Mueller in with a look at some of the healthcare issues for aging Americans, vision problems among them. He'll have a look at that after 11. Catherine Brond in for Kathleen Dunn. Right now talking numbers and statistics with Jeffrey Rosenthal, making a difficult subject easy to understand. His new book about the curious world of probabilities. It's called Struck by Lightning. And there's still time for you to get in with a question or comment, from those ubiquitous opinion polls to playing the lottery, mathematical reasoning and ways we can apply in our daily lives. 800-642-1234. And before we go back to the phones, Jeffrey Rosenthal, I wanted to ask you, is there such a thing as an unlucky person or a lucky person?
Yeah. Well, there are certainly people who have been unlucky and have been lucky. I would argue that there's nothing sort of intrinsic to the person. You know, sometimes in the movies they have, you know, this guy is bad luck, and if he's in the room, bad things are going to happen. And I don't believe people have that magic power. But certainly, you know, to any one person, things could happen that are good or things could happen that are bad. And, of course, some people have very unlucky lives and very sad things happen to them. So people can have unlucky things, but it doesn't mean that there's something intrinsically unlucky about them.
Okay. And you use an example in your book, coin flipping. You get 10 heads in a row, and, you know, that's pretty rare if you just start flipping. But if you're flipping for several hours and get 10 heads in a row, well, then you think, well, that's bound to happen.
Right.
Is that what we mean when we say to somebody who's down on their luck, oh, your luck's bound to change at some point?
Yeah, well, partially. I mean, so there's two related things to the sort of, you know, law of large numbers or things balancing out in the long run, and one of them's right and one of them's not quite right. So one example is, let's say you're at a casino and somebody's betting on craps, and let's say, you know, they've won 8 times in a row. Then it's interesting. Some people will think, oh, you know, this guy's hot. I'm going to bet that he's going to win again because he's obviously on a roll. Other people will think, oh, look, he's already used up all his good luck and things have to change, so I'm actually going to bet against him. In that case, they're both wrong, actually. Just because he won 8 times in a row, it doesn't affect whether or not you're going to win the next time. It's still the same 49.29% chance of winning at craps each time you start a fresh game. And with flipping coins, it's the same thing. If you flip 10 coins and get 10 heads, still the next coin is equally likely to be heads and tails, heads or tails. But what is true is that over the long run of, you know, if you flip lots and lots of coins, about half of them will be heads, or if you play craps over and over and over again, about 49.29% of the time will you win. So in the long run, things even out, but any one time, anything can still happen.
Mm. It's funny to think about luck as something that can be used up.
Yeah, well, it isn't really, but some people do think that way.
All right. David is next in Ironwood. Hi, David.
Oh, that's the very point that I was going to make, the bell curve, the outlying. I mean, with this many people on Earth, there's bound to be someone who probably won every single lottery they ever entered and someone lose every lottery they ever entered. Yet those two people, get them together, they have the same chance of winning the next lottery they both enter. It's just interesting.
Yeah.
Another interesting thing is probability and stuff. If I threw a glass of water into a river, I don't know exactly what half that glass of water is going to take down that river. But I'm pretty sure it's going to be between the two banks. A little chaos theory.
Yeah.
Like, I find this fascinating. And then the Denning, you can mention something about him and his statistics to keep production going good.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's a few issues in there, actually. When you mentioned the pouring the glass of water into the river, I thought you were going to say, and it reminded me of something else, which is sort of a fascinating thing. It says, say you take a glass of water and you pour it into a river or an ocean, and then you wait a few years, so all the waters of the earth get all mixed up through rain and storms and so on, and then you go back to the ocean and you fill up your glass with water, then you can say, will there be any molecules of water in your glass, which were in the previous glass too? And it turns out that, of course, any one molecule is very unlikely that it's going to come back to your glass because, you know, there's so much water in the world and oceans and so on. But nonetheless, molecules are so small that there's so many molecules involved that actually over 1,000 molecules in the new glass will be from the old glass. So sort of an indication of how small molecules are and how, you know, even though any one molecule is extremely unlikely, when you mix them all up, it's still likely that some molecule will come back.
That's exactly the way I would have thought of it.
Well, it's just what came into my head. It's that imagination we were talking about.
Right. All right. Thanks, David, very much for the call. Next is Roger in Gordon. Hi there.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I've got a couple of questions. In talking with my friends about the lottery, if, you know, if there's a, if they buy one ticket, there's one in 100, you know, one in 10 million chance of winning, just assuming the 10 million is the right number. They say they can buy 100 tickets and have 100 chances. That, you know, then their chances are 110 million. And I argue with them and say, no, you've got 101 in 10 million chances of winning. Who's correct?
But you're saying 101 chances?
No, 101 in a 10 million chances.
Right. Well, I mean, that's pretty much the same thing, I guess. It depends if it's a lottery where you sort of pick your numbers, and if you do buy 100 tickets and you make sure that you don't pick the same numbers in more than one ticket, then it is actually true that your chance of matching the jackpot is 100 times as much as it was if you just bought one ticket. So that is true. But on the other hand, you have to pay more money to do it, and it's still very unlikely you're going to win the jackpot. So it's not really a good strategy anyway.
The other question is I get really upset with the newscasters when they're talking about percentage figures. They'll report something that says something is 6%, the other one's 4%, so there's 2% difference.
Mm.
It's 2 percentage points difference. It's actually 33% difference, not 2%. And it happens all the time.
That's a good distinction to make.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's kind of related to the previous caller talking about the decaffeinated coffee, right? And, you know, something is 99% caffeine-free, does that mean 99% of the coffee or 99% of the caffeine? Or if, you know, it's 33% reduced, does that mean it's a third, you know, two-thirds of what it was before? So basically in all those things, you just kind of make sure you understand what they really mean or else you can be tricked.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Roger. Next is Ron in Madison. Hi, Ron.
Some processes are not random, and we need to recognize that fact. In the early 70s, the U.S. government drafted guys to go to Vietnam using birthdays, which apparently was a lottery and random.
Okay.
Before that, in the 60s, it was very biased.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you an example from history. There were 16 boys graduated from an ex-high school in 1968. Three of those boys had graduated from a Catholic grade school 4 years earlier. The other 13 had graduated from that public school or somewhere else. So there were only three Catholics out of 16. You take the odds. 3 over 16 times 2 over 15 times 1 over 14 is 6 over 3360, which is one chance out of 560 that these three Catholics would have been picked randomly to go to Vietnam.
So it sounds like there was something deliberate, perhaps, going on. Jeffrey Rosenthal?
Yeah, well, it certainly could be. I mean, I'm familiar with the lottery system that was used later on, but in fact, I think part of the reason the lottery system for the draft was brought in is because, first of all, people wanted more certainty to know what was going to happen to them. And second of all, I think to eliminate this issue of how was it being done, was it being done randomly and so on. And those are huge issues. You know, with any important issue, like who's going to be drafted or who's going to be chosen for something, you know, it should be as transparent as possible and as random as possible to be fair. It's interesting that randomness becomes what makes it fair. And if you don't have that, if you just have some guy in an office deciding, then it could be his own biases and his own preferences, absolutely.
Right. Now, you point out that we're often forced to assess randomness when making decisions. And your sort of rule of thumb is that we ignore events of extremely low probability, one in a million, for instance.
Yeah.
And you say if we take that to extremes, there's the chance we might be negligent or reckless and that this could lead to indifference. And certainly when one thinks about voting, you know, that could be a problem as a society.
Yeah,
you know,
well,
we think, oh, our vote's not going to count, or
right.
I don't have to recycle.
Yeah.
One piece of garbage isn't going to make a difference.
Yeah.
Why bother?
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, to the first part of the question, I would say, you know, we all the time ignore unlikely events. For example, every time you drive a car across town, I calculate in the book that there's approximately one chance in 7 million that you'll be in an accident involving a fatality. So, you know, we just say, well, look, you know, one chance in 7 million or whatever it is just small enough that we're not going to decide, oh, I'm not going to go over to my daughter's house for dinner tonight because, ooh, something bad could happen. We just say, look, we're just not going to let that affect us. But then, as you say, it's interesting, certain things like, say, voting is a good example. There's the issue of sort of individual rationality versus collective rationality, in the sense that it is true that any one person voting is very unlikely in a big election to make the difference. But on the other hand, as you say, if lots and lots of people don't vote, then that will certainly make a difference. So it's one of these things that, you know, it'd be fine for one person not to vote, but then that's contagious. So, as I actually quote in the book from Jean-Paul Sartre as best as I can with my limited knowledge of philosophy, but that somehow there's an idea that when we do an action, we're actually sort of saying this is what everyone should do. There's a bit of that. So if you don't vote, you're sort of implicitly saying, well, I don't think other people should bother to vote either. And that's where the problem comes in. So that's why I think we should all vote, because somehow if you don't vote, somebody else won't vote too, and that's where the problem comes.
Right. We want them to follow our example.
Yeah, that's right, that kind of thing.
Okay. Quick call from Tony in Brookfield. Hi, Tony.
Hi. As you were talking before about unusual circumstances and people attribute those unusual circumstances to perhaps supernatural causes, I was thinking about, is there a way that you can use statistical methods to determine whether or not there is a God?
Whoa, yeah. That's a big question. Big
right.
Question, Jeffrey Rosenthal.
That's a great question to end on, because there's nowhere to go from there, right? But it is an interesting. I mean, I do get asked about that because, you know, there's scientists and then there's people who are religious, and many scientists are religious. In fact, I am not religious. But on the other hand, I think, I think what one can say is that if there is a God, then he has chosen to run the world according to scientific principles. So in other words, what we can measure and what we can study conforms to the science that we understand. And, of course, there's more science to be learned, but we see the regularities that things proceed according to scientific principles. So if there is somebody with a master plan, well, he's decided to make that master plan work according to science. So to me, you know, what you ultimately believe is, of course, up to you, but it's important to understand the way, you know, science says that probabilities and randomness and other things work, because that's the way the world works. For whatever reason, that's the way the world works, and that's what we have to deal with, I think.
All right. And on that note, we end it there. What a fun hour it's been, Jeffrey Rosenthal. I think I'm going to go out and see bell curves everywhere.
That's the spirit.
Pleasure having you with us. Jeffrey Rosenthal, professor in the Department of Statistics at the University of Toronto. We've been talking about his latest book, Struck by Lightning: The Curious World of Probabilities. It's just out in paperback by Joseph Henry Press.